This is your reading of the Pantograph newspaper for Monday, May 26th, 2025, Memorial Day. Return to rest, a complex task. Native ancestors return to rest, a paperwork laid in process underway in Illinois. Two of the country's largest collections of Native American human remains are held by museums in Illinois. To the director of one of the museums, the work to rebury those remains at the behest of a tribal nation or send them to the tribe is an emotional process necessary for correcting historic wrongs. But it also includes a lot of bureaucratic paperwork that can take months to years to process. And it takes so long for a reason. The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, is a federal law that requires a museum or institution to publish public notices if any human remains or funerary objects it holds belong to a tribal nation. NAGPRA has existed in a couple of forms since 1990, when Congress first passed it. By December 2023, the U.S. Department of Interior gave clarification about the now 35-year-old law. Museums and institutions with human remains must reach out to the tribal nations first, not the other way around. Different groups noted this update to NAGPRA is particularly important. Before this, institutions did not have to reach out to tribal nations first, although some institutions were already doing so, like the Illinois State Museum in Springfield or University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. But even with the change, tribal and museum representatives note the return process is slow. Raphael Wawasuk, a council member and citizen of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation, Illinois' only federally recognized tribe, said when he started as the tribe's point of contact for NAGPRA, he was initially greeted by stacks of paperwork. "I had banker's boxes, probably 4 high, 10 rows deep, of notices that come in," Wawasuk said. "Since that time, we've cleaned up our internal processes to where now we're asking for a lot of electronic notices. I could probably check my phone right now and have maybe 50, and it's just, I don't know that it will ever slow down." Two state-run museums and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign are making progress on their repatriation efforts with the help of recent legislation. But a small nonprofit museum near the state's western border has been slower at complying with the repatriation process. Institutions have until 2029 to publish all of their notices. If they don't, they can face civil penalties from the U.S. Department of Interior. A base penalty was established by the DOI for thousands of dollars, which can be increased based on damages tribes suffered or on the historical, commercial, ceremonial, cultural, or archaeological value. Before the most recent NAGPRA revision, the DOI collected about $60,000 in civil penalties between fiscal year 1990 and fiscal year 2024. The Illinois State Museum and Dixon Mounds Museum are both divisions of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. The Illinois State Museum is in Springfield, just beside the Capitol. Dixon Mounds, a museum built atop burial mounds, is in Lewistown, southwest of Peoria. Combined, the two institutions hold the second largest collection of Native human remains of any institution in the country. Of the 5,789 remains it holds, about 26% have notices published in the Federal Register. Last year, over 1,000 notices were published all at once as part of a multi-year effort. Both locations have been home to controversy over the years, as they had human remains of Native Americans on display for public viewing in decades past, which modern-day American anthropologists would generally consider unethical. Logan Pappenfort, director of tribal relations for the Illinois State Museum and formerly the interim director of Dixon Mounds Museum, has been doing NAGPRA work for years. Before living in Illinois, Pappenfort was the Peoria Tribe of Oklahoma's Director of Cultural Preservation, where he is also a citizen. The Peoria Tribe has historic ties to central Illinois, having lived for centuries in the current-day Lake Michigan and St. Louis areas. He said the reasons it takes so long for remains to be returned and reburied are complicated. Pappenfort said excavation of human remains wasn't consistently regulated for decades. NAGPRA's passage created some regulations for excavating on federal land or land near federal tribes, but it was still up to states and even counties to designate guidelines for remains found on private property. At the Dixon Mounds Museum, a chiropractor named Don Dixon dug up some burial mounds on his property in the 1900s and built a museum on top of it so people could see into the ground below them. The state acquired it in 1945 so it could be turned into a state park. Native Americans widely protested the museum for decades, as it previously displayed human remains until 1992, when it closed to remove remains from display at the behest of former Governor Jim Edgar. Then it reopened in 1994. The state hasn't published notices for about 74% of the remains held by ISM and Dixon Mounds, and Pappenfort acknowledged there's still work to do. However, he said it's unlikely that the state ever reduces the number of remains in its care to zero. The main reason? The Illinois State Museum serves as a repository for any remains found in other institutions within state borders that can't be identified. While Wasik said remains can sometimes be found unexpectedly across the state. I was just at another institution the other day, and when I first met with them, they assured me that they didn't have anything in their collections, Wasik said. Well, one of their long-tenured employees retired, and as they were cleaning out their workplace, lo and behold, they found a box, and within the box was remains and other items. And so then that caused them to do a complete overview of their entire organization, and, sure enough, they found that they had many, many ancestral remains and other items. And it wasn't anything intentional by the organization, per se. The state has been trying to make sure that remains can be reburied swiftly to keep up with federal law and be respectful to Native communities. That's why the General Assembly gave IDNR the power in 2023 to control a private cemetery so reburial could be a valid option. Now, Pappenfort said most tribes opt to rebury ancestors in IDNR's private, secretive burial site instead of taking them out of state and reburying them there, which can be seen as akin to removal all over again. In the 1990s, when NAGPRA was new, my tribe, we brought ancestors back to Oklahoma from Illinois because we did not have the confidence at that point that they would not be disturbed again if they were reburied here, Pappenfort said. Now, through agreements, legislation, relationships built, there is a confidence that this is where they will be if they are reburied here. And so, that's been one of those things that's not been overnight. I mean, this has been a relationship-building exercise 30 years in the making. Senator Mark Walker, Democrat of Arlington Heights, who was trained as an anthropologist, helped pass the bill that would allow Native American remains to be reburied by IDNR. Walker said reburial was something he found people were open to because it avoided remains retracing the Trail of Tears by leaving the state to somewhere else. The bill allows us to gather those remains and put them back where we got them, to reinter them, to have their own cemetery, to bury them with honor, Walker said at the time. The Center for American Archaeology in Campsville, which has the second largest collection of Native human remains in the state and 13th largest in the country, has not published any public notices to the Federal Register, despite holding almost 2,000 remains. The museum in Calhoun County on the state's western border is a nonprofit that receives federal grants, making it subject to NAGPRA. It's been operating since 1953. The center's director said its collection came from excavations since the 1950s. According to its website, due to multiple floods and the COVID-19 shutdown, the museum closed until a new building could be built. But the rebuilding project has been put on hold indefinitely, because of a federal freeze on awarded Federal Emergency Management Agency grants. The director of the center, Jason King, told Capital News Illinois none of the remains were damaged during the floods because none of them were publicly displayed. He also said he has reached out to 25 tribes since the updates to NAGPRA. In 2023, before the update to the law, King told ProPublica, to date, no tribes have requested repatriation of remains or objects from the CAA. ProPublica's series, published in that year, identified how America's museums fail to return Native American human remains, identifying how Illinois was one of the worst states for repatriation. King, who has served as director of the center since 2017, noted that it doesn't have the resources of larger institutions. The nature of how this operates has changed over time, and my read on the center's history and what we're doing now is that we are a different kind of organization than a university or the state system, King said. We are making a good faith effort to do the best we can to move this process forward. King said the bulk of the remains the center holds are from field excavations from various research programs over the years. Nowadays, the center conducts field research after receiving permits from the state to excavate what were once sites of homes or refuse pits. Notices are published closer to when remains are ready for repatriation. So while the center has reached out to tribes, it's unclear whether those conversations will bear fruit until notices have been published in the National Park Service's NAGPRA database. In central Illinois, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign created a NAGPRA office in 2020 to do the kind of work that was eventually turned into a requirement of the law. Since the university created the NAGPRA office and has actually dedicated time and staff and resources, things like that, to NAGPRA, that's why we've been able to so greatly increase our activity in the last few years, said Christiana Krupa, UIUC Senior Program Officer for NAGPRA. Since the office's creation, there's been a significant spike in notices made by the university, with 70% of its 192 total notices being made since 2020. Krupa said most of the remains that UIUC holds come from the anthropology department going on faculty excavations over the decades. Of the 760 human remains held by the university, there have been 192 notices sent to tribes. The majority of those notices were sent after the university started its NAGPRA office. Another complicating factor is that many remains are considered culturally unidentifiable. In the original NAGPRA text, remains could only be repatriated or reburied if they could be definitively linked to a specific tribal nation. Without a direct, definitive tie, the culture couldn't be identified. For tribal nations, this could be tricky because of how frequently people were forcibly removed from the land. And before European colonialism, land control varied over the course of history. So, finding out which tribe was somewhere at a certain time could sometimes be complicated, which is why the update to NAGPRA's definition of cultural affiliation can be important. The U.S. Department of Interior said a tribe's cultural affiliation to remains could at least be reasonably identified by the geographical location or acquisition history of the human remains or cultural items. With just the preponderance of a cultural connection required, remains that couldn't definitively be linked to any single tribe are going through the NAGPRA process instead of staying stuck in collections. Papenport said preparing remains for reburial is a delicate and emotional process. Every day I was doing that work was a toll emotionally for me because I am essentially preparing people I think of as my ancestors for burial. All of us have a handful of times in our life that we experience grief. And in a day, I could experience that same grief 100 times, Papenfort said. I remember there are a couple days that I even had to step away and collect myself. And so that type of work is hard work, but it's also heart work, and it has to come from somewhere in here. Purple Heart returned to family of Illinois World War II veteran. In the hard-fought campaign to liberate the Philippines during World War II, 22-year-old Army Corporal Henry Vandernoord of suburban Lansing was hit with shrapnel during a key battle on the island of Luzon. Van der Noord survived, as did three brothers who also served their country in the war, and earned a Purple Heart for the combat injury he suffered in May 1945. This month, as Memorial Day approached, Van der Noord's firstborn grandchild, Chris Reed, held the heart-shaped medal for the first time in about 25 years after Illinois Treasurer Michael Frerichs presented it to him during a poignant ceremony in Atlanta. Frerichs' office had preserved the medal in a government vault since 2020 when a Geneva bank turned it over to the state from an abandoned safe deposit box. Reed told the Tribune he had lost track of the box during his frequent moves while serving in the U.S. Air Force. Reed, who now lives outside Atlanta, said his grandfather had given him the medal in the 1970s when he was 8 or 9 years old. He smiled as Frerichs opened a small weathered case to reveal not only his grandfather's medal, but also the pencil markings that Reed, as a young boy, had scribbled inside the lid. "It was a cool box, but I had no idea at the time what it really meant," said Reed, 57, who came to realize the medal's significance as he grew older and through his own military service. "I never really put two and two together back then about what he endured," he said. "He did almost make the ultimate sacrifice." The Illinois Treasurer is the state's custodian of unclaimed property, which includes everything from lost bank accounts and insurance policies to stamps, coins, jewelry, and military medals. The Treasurer's office has returned an estimated $2.2 billion in forgotten cash and stock to individuals, employers, and nonprofits during Frerichs' 3 terms, according to the office. The Treasurer launched a special effort, Operation Purple Heart, in late 2021, to raise awareness about the unclaimed medals. To date, Frerichs has returned 13 Purple Hearts, including the most recent medal belonging to Van der Noord, presented to Reed on May 4th. Last winter, the Tribune wrote about its own efforts to identify the veterans behind the remaining unclaimed Purple Hearts. After months of researching public records and interviewing people linked to the safe deposit boxes, the Tribune succeeded in 10 of the 11 cases on the Treasurer's public list. At the time, Van der Noord's medal was not included on that list. Members of the office reached out to Reed earlier this year after tracking him down near Atlanta. The Treasurer's office has been working to verify the claims of families who have come forward following the Tribune's reporting, officials said. Henry Van der Noord died February 3, 1991, at the age of 68. A retired Lansing police lieutenant, he last lived in the small Kankakee County city of Moments, about 50 miles south of Chicago, where Reed said his grandfather loved to spend his days on the river in his fishing boat. Reed, who was in his early 20s when his grandfather died, said Van der Noord didn't speak much about the war. "He was very humble about it," he said. Reed said his grandfather, one of 8 children, earned the nickname Babe within the family because he was an infant when they arrived in the United States from the Netherlands. The moniker stuck even after he went off to war. He was in the Army's 38th Field Artillery Division and traveled to Hawaii, New Guinea, and the Philippines during his estimated 2 years of service, according to his family and public records. During a lengthy recuperation from the shrapnel wound he suffered May 3, 1945, he ended up in the same hospital as one of his older brothers, PFC Edward Van der Noord of the Army's 11th Airborne Division, who had injured his ankle in a parachute jump, according to the Treasurer's office. Henry Van der Noord retired from the Lansing Police Department in 1978 with the rank of lieutenant, according to the department. He had 3 daughters with his first wife, Nellie, who died of breast cancer in the mid-1970s and later remarried. Reed said his grandfather also worked with Edward Van der Noord, building duplexes as well as a large complex in Lansing during the 1970s that bore the family name, the Van der Noord Apartments. "He was a man's man for sure," Reed said of his grandfather, who taught him how to swim by tossing him into a pool, much to the chagrin of his mother. "He was always kind of a carpenter and a hard worker." Reed recalled seeing his grandfather's large scar on his back, but Van der Noord didn't offer too many details. He would touch on it briefly, and then my mom would give the rest of the story, Reed said. Though he shielded his family from the atrocities he experienced at war, Reed knew what Vander Noord's service meant to him. In fact, he was so patriotic and such a big fan of General Douglas MacArthur that his grandfather offered his mother and father $1,000 in 1967 to name him Douglas, Reed said. They declined, but Reed noted one of his aunts did take her dad up on the offer. Chris Reed left Illinois in his late teens, enlisting in the Air Force and moving around the country during his estimated 20 years of service, split between active duty and the reserves. He had put the Purple Heart in a bank deposit box for safekeeping, last seeing it circa 1995 to 2000. Reed said he was honored when Frerich's staff came to Georgia to return his grandfather's medal. Truth be told, he's also relieved he didn't have to tell his mother he had misplaced it. Anyone with information about a Purple Heart return, particularly a safe deposit box connected to Robert Cawthon, is urged to contact the Illinois Treasurer's Office at claimantconnect@illinoistreasurer.gov. For more information, visit operationpurpleheart.org. VA referrals to private medical care streamlined. The VA has changed its process for veterans to get medical care from non-VA providers, removing a requirement that a referral to community care be reviewed by a VA administrator or another VA doctor. The law prohibits VA administrators from overriding a VA doctor's referral for a patient to get outside care. The Veterans Care Choice Act of 2014 was helpful in gaining access to health care for veterans who could not get reasonably quick appointments or for veterans who would have to travel over 40 miles for VA care. However, the program was too bureaucratic in nature and failed to solve the problem of access in a timely manner. The Mission Act of 2019 expanded the benefit, now called community care, to include veterans who face more than a 30-minute drive for primary care, or an hour or more for specialty care, or those who can't get an appointment within 20 days for primary care and 28 days for specialty care. Under the Mission Act, eligible veterans could consult with their VA physicians to receive referrals to community care. The VA formally required these referrals to be reviewed internally by an administrative staff member. This arrangement caused a lot of frustration, both for the veteran and the VA professionals. This resulted in an investigation as to whether too many referrals were being reversed by administrative review. The VA this week began training employees to ensure that the community care referral process is followed in compliance with the Act. VA Memorial website includes vets buried overseas. The VA added over 210,000 veterans to its online memorial project for U.S. veterans, including pages for Americans buried in cemeteries overseas. The Veterans Legacy Memorial website includes those interred at locations overseen under the American Battle Monuments Commission, the federal agency that manages U.S. military burial sites in Europe, the United Kingdom, Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. The VA launched the Veterans Legacy Memorial website in 2019 to highlight former service members buried at national cemeteries, providing loved ones the chance to tell their veterans' stories by adding service records, remembrances, photos, historical documents, and more to their personal pages. The project now includes more than 10 million pages, with more than 200,000 submissions made to veterans' pages, according to the VA. The upgraded system now allows veterans to build their own VLM pages and upload images, autobiographies, military achievements, and life milestones. Anything they would want someone to know about them before they die. Visit vlm.cem.va.gov for more information about the Veterans Legacy Monument. In 3 years, military spent $6 billion to recruit, retain. The U.S. military spent more than $6 billion over the past 3 years to recruit and retain service members in what has been a growing campaign to counter enlistment shortfalls. The financial incentives to re-enlist in the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines increased dramatically from 2022 through last year, with the Navy vastly outspending the others, according to funding totals provided by the services. The overall amount of recruiting bonus pay also rose steadily, fueled by significant jumps in spending by the Army and Marine Corps. The military services have routinely poured money into recruiting and retention bonuses over the years, but the totals spiked as Pentagon leaders tried to reverse falling enlistment numbers, particularly as COVID-19 restrictions locked down public events, fairs, and school visits that recruiters relied on to meet with young people. Coupled with an array of new programs, an increased number of recruiters, and adjustments to enlistment requirements, the additional incentives helped the services bounce back from the shortfalls. All but the Navy met their recruiting targets last year. President Donald Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth repeatedly point to Trump's election as a reason for the recruiting rebound. But the enlistment increases began long before last November, and officials tied them more directly to the widespread overhauls that the services have done, including the increased financial incentives. Memorial Day is supposed to be about mourning the nation's fallen service members, but it's come to anchor the unofficial start of summer and a long weekend of discounts on anything from mattresses to lawnmowers. Here are a few things to know about Memorial Day. 1. Why it's celebrated. It's a day of reflection and remembrance of those who died while serving in the U.S. military, according to the Congressional Research Service. The holiday is observed in part by the National Moment of Remembrance, which encourages all Americans to pause at 3 p.m. for a moment of silence. 2. Origin stories. The holiday stems from the American Civil War, which killed more than 600,000 service members, both Union and Confederate, between 1861 and 1865. There's little controversy over the first national observance, what was then called Decoration Day. It occurred May 30, 1868, after an organization of Union veterans called for decorating war graves with flowers, which were in bloom. The practice was already widespread on a local level. Waterloo, New York, began a formal observance on May 5, 1866, and was later proclaimed to be the holiday's birthday. Yet Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, traced its first observance to October 1864, according to the Library of Congress. And women in some Confederate states were decorating graves before the war's end. David Blight, a Yale history professor, points to May 1, 1865, when as many as 10,000 people, many of them black, held a parade, heard speeches, and dedicated the graves of Union dead in Charleston, South Carolina. A total of 267 Union troops died at a Confederate prison and were buried in a mass grave. After the war, members of black churches buried them in individual graves. What happened in Charleston does have the right to claim to be first, if that matters, Blight told the Associated Press in 2011. Controversies. Someone has always lamented the holiday's drift from its original meaning. As early as 1869, the New York Times wrote that the holiday could become sacrilegious and no longer sacred if it focuses more on pomp, dinners, and oratory. In 1871, abolitionist Frederick Douglass feared Americans were forgetting the Civil War's impetus, enslavement, when he gave a Decoration Day speech at Arlington National Cemetery. "We must never forget that the loyal soldiers who rest beneath this sod flung themselves between the nation and the nation's destroyers," Douglass said. How the day was spent, at least by the nation's elective officials, could draw scrutiny for years after the Civil War. In the 1880s, then-President Grover Cleveland was said to have gone fishing and people were appalled, Matthew Dennis, an emeritus history professor at the University of Oregon, told the AP in 2023. In 1911, the Indianapolis 500 held its inaugural race on May 30th, drawing 85,000 spectators. A report from the Associated Press made no mention of the holiday or any controversy. This has been a reading for the Pantograph for May 26th, 2025. Back with more in a moment.